Hello, this is Jesse Liberty, and this is yet another podcast.
Today I have the legendary Charles Petzold, who has been writing about programming for a good 25 years and who wrote the absolutely canonical book on programming Windows that I and everyone I know learned how to program Windows from. Charles, how are you?
I'm doing good. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. And I have to say, I often say I'm thrilled to have you on the show. I am truly thrilled to have you on the show.
Oh, thank you. It's good to be here.
You have written more than your share of books. You have written, as far as I can tell from looking at the list on charlespetzold.com, there are books here going back to the original Windows programming, going back to OS 2, and then coming forward, there are books on inside Windows and programming with C Sharp, applications equal code plus markup, that was a classic, and most recently, this 1,000-page free ebook, Programming Windows Phone 7. How did that last one come about?
Oh, that came about with a friend of mine, Dave Edson, who used to be a technical editor at Microsoft Systems Journal, getting in touch with me via Facebook and saying, we're doing something that we haven't told anybody about, but how would you like to write a book about it? And eventually I went to Microsoft with a select group of ISVs and learned all about Windows Phone. And it looked pretty cool. And I was, because it was Silverlight, and I had been recently doing some Silverlight stuff, and of course I cut my teeth on WPF a few years ago, it looked like something that would be lots of fun.
And was it their idea for the PDF to be given away, or was...
We discussed a couple ways to go about this book. The traditional way, where the author spends a year or so writing the book and then gets, a tiny amount of money. And a slightly different way, where it would be a work-for-hire job. And the second approach was the one that we went with. So that allowed me to get paid, and it allowed the book to be made available free. You can think of me in these terms. You can think of me as some kind of advertising agency where I wrote a book that basically advertises the Windows Phone API to developers, or you could think of me as a book whore who will write anything for money. However, whichever way you want to go with it, I had a lot of fun writing the book, and I hope it helps Windows Phone, because I'm enjoying my Windows Phone a great deal, both as a user and a programmer.
Well, I, at the risk of sounding like I'm saying this just because you're here, I think that the book's quality prohibits thinking of you as either a hack or a programmer. But one of the things that you have done throughout your writing is to intersperse some extraordinary books that are not how-to books for programmers, such as The Annotated Turing, and you also have a book called Code, the Hidden Language of Computer Hardware and Software. Are those part of your standard writing, or are those more works out of love? How did those come about?
Oh, those, as you correctly deduce, those are very special books, and they are very special books to me, and they are basically labors of love. I had the idea for Code came about when I was doing a column for PC Magazine back in 85, I guess, where readers would write in questions, technical questions, and I'd answer them. I forget what the column was called, but it was a popular column, and somebody asked about what ANDs and OR gates have to do, AND and OR logic have to do with programming. And I answered the question but I really started thinking about, wouldn't it be nice to start from a very basic place with switches and build switches into logic gates and start putting logic gates to form adders and like build a whole computer from that in a book. I thought that would be interesting, and I couldn't see that anybody else had ever done something like that. Of course, there were textbooks on digital logic design and stuff like that, but nobody had really done a book for the general reader about how computers actually work with the bits and the bytes in there. And so I wrote the first 100 pages just to see if I could carry this off. And I sent it to my agent, Claudette Moore, and she sent it to Microsoft Press, and they liked it. And so that book came about.
The book reads like it was written by Douglas Hofstetter. It has that kind of inquiring approach to it.
Thank you. Thank you. I enjoy reading a lot of pop science and pop math books. I am struggling with both code and annotated Turing. Not struggling, but I wouldn't mind at all if one of those books jumped the boundary, the border, you know, into a pop science or a pop book, math book that ended up what I think of as the first floor of the Barnes & Noble store, you know, rather than being relegated to the computer section.
Right. And that is a huge challenge, is getting those books out there and letting people know that they exist. Although you have a significant following for a number of years, and they really are sort of that look inside the brain of the man who wrote the other books.
Yeah, I don't know if my so-called reputation actually does anything. I recently did a couple of years ago a book on WPF 3D, and that book basically bombed. It never made back the advance, even in what I consider to be my market. And even with a book like that 3D programming book, which I thought WPF programmers would be thrilled about the idea of constructing animated 3D scenes entirely in markup. I mean, that's an amazing thing to be able to do, but apparently not. And Annotated Turing, I am happy to say, recently made back its advance. So I got an actual four-figure royalty check, a semi-annual royalty check for just a little over $1,000. So that's always a pleasure to get something like that.
Yeah, that one I would put up on the wall, because for a book like The Annotated Turing, which I should say the subtitle of that is A Guided Tour Through Alan Turing's History Paper, or is it Historic Paper?
Yes. Historic Paper on Computability and the Turing Machine. Yes.
That's quite a, well, I have to say it sounds like a bit of an esoteric book, and yet the sales were good enough to sell out the advance. That's quite an accomplishment.
Yeah, I think that book has the possibility of having some good academic sales as well, because some college professors have mentioned to me that it might make a good textbook for an introductory course on computability theory. It takes computability theory, you know, from a Turing perspective, but with a lot of historical background too, and a lot of follow-up chapters about what it really means in as far as computers go, and as far as our understanding of the universe goes, in fact, our understanding of the human mind as well.
That's great. I have to tell you, I have to confess to you that my knowledge of Turing is mostly from Neal Stephenson and his books in science fiction on Turing. What are you working on now? Are you writing anything new?
Yeah, it's kind of funny. I was recently doing another book that is still under NDA. And so that book may or may not. It's the whole subject is under NDA. And I've just recently done a Google search just today of the subject of this book. And there's nothing turns up in Google whatsoever. This product is under really deep NDA, and it's kind of weird to be writing a book about it and not being able to talk about it. I'm also preparing to do a revision of the Windows Phone book for Mango, and that'll be a few months of work for me, possibly through the end of the year. I'm not sure. I've also been working on a series of articles for MSDN Magazine that started out very innocently, but have evolved into a series of articles about programming an ebook reader for Windows Phone. And this ebook reader uses plain text files downloaded from Project Gutenberg. These are like 35,000 books in the public domain, and paginates them and allows you to flip through them and look at the table of contents and set bookmarks and make annotations and do things like that. It's been evolving into a fairly sophisticated Windows Phone program, at least the most sophisticated Windows Phone program that I've written so far. And I've really been enjoying that.
And are those articles already out?
Some of them, I haven't checked when the most recent one is. I'm about to send them at the article for the October issue, which is basically the reader part of it finished. And the only thing that it's missing is a front end to actually download the books. So in honor of October and Halloween, this ebook reader only allows you to read 4 books: Frankenstein, Dracula, Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, and Henry James, A Turn of the Screw, for horror classics. The next step, of course, will be the whole front end that allows you to download books from Project Gutenberg. And I ran into a little bit of a hitch with that, because even though Project Gutenberg is a terrific site, and they lean over backwards to make these books freely available, and they encourage people to use the books in whatever way they want, they do not have a web service that accesses the Gutenberg catalog. So, and this catalog is like 200 megs in size. It's a big XML file. And it's an XML file of such a format that Silverlight for Windows Phone can't even parse it using the XML reader that's in Silverlight. So I've been making my own web service that grabs this catalog from Gutenberg and parses it and makes it into a form where it's very easily searchable, and then making this web service available to the Windows Phone app. So it's turning into like a classic a phone app, where it's a local application working in conjunction with a web service.
Interesting that you had to write your own web service to be able to make that work. Is that something you'll make available to Project Gutenberg?
I'm not quite sure. I'm sure they could do it on their own. It's the web service. The logic of the web service itself is not a big deal. And it's mostly a matter of how you want to specify a search, and the Gutenberg website. They must have some kind of, I'm not sure what they have built into it to actually do these searches, but they allow searches in a variety of ways. I'm only allowing a search by specifying title words and or author words. And then it depends what the information you're sending back to the app. I'm limiting the information to just what I need on the app. So I'm not sure they'd really care about this particular web service for themselves.
Fair enough. The MSDN articles that you're writing, is the source code going to be available for that?
Oh, yeah, the source code for, yes. And I actually haven't checked with my editor yet whether I can do this, but I want to make the final app available for free on the Windows Phone Marketplace. So the app will be free to use, and all the source code will be available.
Fantastic. That will be a great resource. Let me change subject slightly and ask you how you spend your day. Is your full day spent on writing, or do you also do some form of consulting?
A few years ago, book royalties stopped being able to support me.
Or anyone else, for that matter, I'm afraid to say.
Yeah. Unfortunately, this happened at not a good time. I had expected the 3D book to do very well. And so I expected royalties from that to come rushing in and be able to support my finishing the annotated touring, which I had been working on and off for years. So I had these back-to-back book contracts for the 3D book, the WPF 3D book, and the annotated touring. Neither of them were very big advances, and both of them required a lot of time. And I just had to start doing some consulting. So I am affiliated with Wintellect, which is a little consulting firm that was started up by some good friends of mine from the old days, Jeff Procise and Jeff Richter and John Robbins. So I am currently doing some work that bounces around from Windows Phone to WPF. I think I'm going to be doing a little bit of a web service now. So it's been fun.
So your time is spent doing consulting for them and also writing. Are you looking forward? Is there a particular project you have in mind for another one of these labors of love?
Oh, yeah. In fact, I recently, you want to put something else, another link on your website, put it to Ada's Technical Books. It's a new bookstore. It's in Seattle, and it's devoted to technical books, and it's a wonderful little bookstore. And of course, being a new independent bookstore, we just, who knows if it's how long it's going to be around, but they have a really nice inventory and a really cool place. And I recently was out in Seattle, did a little talk and signing there. And instead of talking about books I've written, I talked about the 6 books I want to write in the future, all of which are kind of these weird combinations of programming history, computer history, and computer prehistory, and math, and throw in some philosophy there as well. The one that's really up on top of the list for me is a book about a tide predicting machine that William Thomson, otherwise known as Lord Kelvin, designed and implemented in the 1870s. And there's lots of different aspects of this particular machine that are interesting. It's considered a very early general purpose analog computer. Because basically it sums up sine curves in that have been derived from Fourier analysis of tidal patterns for a particular port. But there are other aspects of it in the history of it that make it very interesting. This is a book that several years ago, I think during the lull, I had a little work lull when Windows Presentation Foundation, WPF, almost came out, but then didn't for a couple years. Yes. And it was called, what was it called before? Longhorn? No, it wasn't called Longhorn. It was called something else, the code. Anyway, I had a little work lull, unexpected work lull, and I spent a good 6 months working on this book, and I actually finished several chapters, and I was so unhappy with them. They weren't really what I envisioned, and they weren't compelling reading, and I really want to take another shot at this book. So that's one of them. And there are other books on the list.
Well, let me stop you for just a second and push on that book that you were just discussing, which is, what is the timing of that? Was that machine created before or after the difference engine, Charles Babbage's difference engine?
Several decades after. So historically, you have a very significant digital computer, Babbage's machine, which was Babbage had the whole design of that analytical engine in his head in the 1830s. And this was late 1860s, early 1870s.
So Lady Lovelace missed the machine you're discussing.
She was Oh, yeah.
That's a shame. It sounds like something that she would have really been intrigued by.
Yeah.
There've been quite a bit written about various pieces of the early history of computing, but I'm not sure that anything has really tied it together into anything like a timeline.
There are a couple good books on the history of computers, but one of the things that I'm particularly interested in is what's called the prehistory of computing, which is the period before 1940, let's say. By the early 1940s, people pretty much knew how computers should be designed. And everything in the 70 years since then has been pretty much refinements. Before 1940, there was some confusion about it. Turing was right before that period when he wrote the famous paper in 1936. And there were other people doing interesting things in the 1930s. But prior to that, with the exception of Babbage, you had these interesting analog computers. And in the modern day, we tend to scoff at these things without really knowing anything about them. But the Lord Kelvin tide predicting machine was a special purpose analog computer that was actually very elegant in how it performed rather complex calculations. Another one was the differential analyzer, which was built in the 1920s, designed by Vannevar Bush. Vannevar Bush later went on to run the Manhattan Project. He later wrote a article about something he called the memics, which was a kind of predecessor to hyperlinking of documents. But in the 1920s, he designed and built this thing called a differential analyzer, which solved differential equations using entirely mechanical means. And so there's these very interesting analog computers that were being built that have really not been written about all that much. And one of the things that makes them interesting is that they do things purely mechanically that require a lot of processing in digital computers. For example, in the tide predicting machine, there's a very simple mechanism you can hook together that will trace out a sine curve when you turn a crank. Now, in order to generate a sine curve in a digital computer, you basically can't generate a sine curve. You have to generate individual values of the sine function. Each individual value of the sine function is an infinite summation that's being performed. It doesn't go infinite, of course. It goes as far as it needs with to get the accuracy that you want, but it's being performed in a math coprocessor. To see the difference between how the modern digital computer does it, which is very clunky, and the elegance that the analog computer does it, it's really amazing. So a book that shows these different methods, that contrast them and all, I think would be interesting. And not an easy book to write, obviously. Vannevar Bush died in the early 1970s, but before he did, he wrote a memoir called Pieces of the Action, which is a wonderful read. You really hear his voice coming through. But he said that they had hired basically a mechanic to set up these differential analyzers. They needed to set one up in a different place. And this guy, with no formal training, developed an intuitive understanding of differential equations just by working with this machine. And that, I consider, that sounds so extraordinary for that to happen. And of course, it's not going to happen with working with digital computers. Even if you write a program that solves a differential equation, you are not going to have an intuitive understanding of the physical processes behind that equation. Whereas with a analog computer, where you have mechanical mechanisms that simulate these real life processes, you get a better understanding of it. So I think that we've lost something in our obsession to turn everything into numbers on the digital computer. I think that we've become estranged from or alienated from the physical processes that these digital computers encapsulate. I'll give you another example. In the both you and I are old enough to remember phonograph records, which have a groove that goes from the outside to the inside of the disc. And if you look at that groove very carefully and with a magnifying glass, you'll see that there's little bumps in the groove. And those bumps correspond to the waveform of the sound that's encoded on the record. So you can really get a sense of this whole process of a person singing or a musical instrument playing, creating vibrations of sound, and then that being picked up by the microphone membrane and being transferred to electrical impulses, which then move a needle up and down to cut the record. And then the process on the other end, the needle bounces up and down in the groove, and it goes through the speaker, which vibrates in the same way. So you really get much more of a sense of the sound, how the sound is encoded on the phonograph record. Whereas with CDs, and man, I wouldn't give up my CDs for phonograph records any day, but you lose all that. It's gone.
Yes. The closest analog in my life is that I used to be able to strip down and repair my car. And that gave clear sense of what was going on in the engine. Now it's just...
Forget about it now.
What is it, Arthur C. Clarke's comment about any sufficiently complex...
yeah.
Is tantamount to magic.
Yeah. The other, I built a little darkroom in my apartment and did black and white photography and stuff and processed the film and made prints and stuff. And that's another area where you really get a sense of how the light affects the film light and dark areas and you're transferring that to a print. And again, a lot of that natural process is lost when everything becomes digital.
Yes, there's an interesting other point associated with that, which is that when we first saw digital processing software, it used analogous terminology. So you would see burn and dodge as actual commands or controls on the software. That's actually giving way now, and you're just seeing direct controls that modify the contrast or modify the amount of illumination. So we are really moving further and further away from the original processing.
Too bad.
Well, on the other hand, we don't have to have neck braces anymore to hold you steady for 4 minutes of flash. So,
One of these other books on my big to-do list is about logarithms. And when logarithms were invented, logarithms originally invented to make multiplication easier because they basically turned multiplication into addition. And an astronomer like Kepler was just overjoyed when he discovered this book about logarithms, because it just speeded up his calculations enormously. And the logarithms led to slide rules and things like that. I grew up, I got a slide rule for my graduation from high school from my mother, and learned in high school how to use log tables to do multiplications. And it's using a slide rule, you really get a sense of magnitude and all, which again is something you don't get with doing a calculation with a calculator. I suspect there's a lot of people growing up who don't really see any difference between the amount of labor required for an addition versus a multiplication. They're basically the same on a calculator. They're just as different symbol.
Right.
Whereas if you're doing it by hand, you know there's a big difference. And so that, I think that because we've lost log tables, we've lost slide rules, that again, we're becoming estranged from the magnitudes that the numbers are representing. We're dealing only with numbers now, and they're too divorced from what they're supposed to represent.
But this lament has been since the beginning of technology. When the telephone came, it was to destroy the art of letter writing. And we've seen this when the car came, there was the loss of socializing with your neighbors. We've seen those trade-offs all along. I'm not suggesting that it's without a price.
Yeah.
I'd hate for the headline coming out of this discussion to be that Charles Petzold is now the voice of Luddites. Hardly fits with
who you are. As someone who is addicted to my Windows phone and will look up something in Wikipedia at a moment's notice, whenever somebody ends a sentence with a question mark, I'm there looking it up.
Right, exactly.
I think that one of the ways to satisfy both needs of our amazing digital culture and our amazing analog past is books about that discuss the history of them and bring this stuff into the common view again.
Yes, I totally agree. And I think those would be fascinating books and being aware of the price that we pay. And one of the things that you said was really struck a note for me was that with the slide rule, you had a visceral sense of the magnitude that you were dealing with, and that is lost in a calculator. I think those kinds of insights of the analog device by nature being analogous to reality, mm-hmm, gives you a much more intuitive sense of what you're dealing with that gets abstracted out in the digital. And that, I think that lesson could permeate any number of discussions.
And with the slide rule, you also had to think about what you were doing, because you had to do the decimal point in your head.
Right.
You know, you were just dealing with magnitudes and without decimals. So that part of it, and that was a safeguard against making mistakes. We've all been to out shopping where somebody's rung up a charge on the cash register that's off by an order of magnitude, and they don't even realize it.
Yes.
You know, the person.
Yes, and I often talk with my daughter when she's doing math about the very simple check of, does this make any sense?
Yeah, you know? Exactly.
When it's 100 trillion miles to the sun, does that number make sense to you? But, you know, we're also used as a society, we're used to dealing with extremely large numbers. And if you asked, I think many people, if you asked what is the national debt and gave them a few choices such as, you know, $1 trillion, $1 billion, $100 trillion, I think people would be hard pressed to tell you.
Yeah.
It's very hard to distinguish those orders of magnitude. I'm going to change subjects on you before I let you go. I have to ask you about this photograph that's on your site on charlespetzold.com/bio.html. If you scroll to the bottom, there is this very scary looking picture of you with a rolled up sleeve and a Windows tattoo on your arm.
Yeah,
that's got to be what's the right word for that? An iconic photograph of you. Is that tattoo real?
That tattoo is absolutely real, and it is
brilliant.
It is as fresh as the day it was done, because it almost never sees the sun. I wore like a sleeveless T-shirt around once soon after the tattoo, and it was a magnet for, it was like a nerd magnet. It was very disturbing. Generally, tattoos are, in the parlance of bikers, chick magnets. This tattoo is not. But it was, there's a little bit of a story about that. It was in my very early days of, when I was a kid, I always thought I'd be a novelist or a screenplay writer. And that kind of persisted into adulthood, too. And I always thought for a while that if I were to publish a novel, I would get a tattoo that symbolized something in the novel. And then it came about that I realized that I had written a book called Programming Windows. And at that time, programming, it was about 10 years old. So I thought that having written this book, that it was still in print after 10 years, and 10 years, even generously, is a good 10% of one's entire life, that deserved a tattoo as well. That I was probably never going to write a novel, but let's do the tattoo anyway. So I did. And the second question you ask is, were you drunk when you got it? And of course I was drunk when I got it.
Yeah, actually, my second question was, did it hurt?
Yeah. It's that's one of the reasons why you, no, it didn't hurt that bad, but it's one of the reasons why you get drunk before you get a tattoo.